the younger people when immigration is open completely, like as it is now, and that will have a worsening effect on the demographic crisis that Cuba has had now, I would say, starting as early, in a gradual fashion, starting as early as the early 80s, but accelerated with the passage of time. And this will only worsen that situation because the younger people who are the people who have children are the ones who will have left. So it's a fairly serious crisis, big inflation. And again, the concessions that the government is willing to make will depend very much on how long and how severe this crisis is.
So in the Soviet period, the Soviet Union would buy Cuban sugar
cane, right.
And right. They're not offering any kind of deal like that. Is that because they're not capable of it?
Well, you know, it's a different system. You know, in the, as I also pointed out in my article, in the Soviet Union, it was two bureaucratic states dealing with each other. And in the part of the Soviet Union, their willingness for political reasons, to give concessions that the market, quote unquote, the market economy would not give. The situation now is different. The situation is that this is kind of a, how to call Russia, it's a racketeering capitalist country. You know, that's the only word that comes to mind. And the Russian capitalists are several hundred of them who are immensely wealthy. Their wealth goes back to the 90s when they literally stole public property and appropriated with the agreement of first Yeltsin and then eventually Putin. Because this process started with Yeltsin, no? It's not just Putin, but it got much more advanced. And of course, Putin has been in power a much longer time. So the government is very involved with the so-called private enterprise. But it's not a situation like the Soviet Union, where the Soviet Union, for geopolitical reasons, could give a lot of concessions to Cuba to maintain that knife in the back of the U.S., as Washington would see it. That is no longer really on the table.
There has been some pressure from American business interests to allow more of an opening to Cuba to get in there and do investments. Do you see the United States under that kind of pressure and seeing that the Russians are in there wanting to change the relationship with Cuba?
Well, I think that what some people on the left in the United States, the left I'm also part of, have realized is that the American ruling class are not at all concerned with Cuba. And in fact, for quite some time, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is a very conservative right-wing organization, has been for a long time in favor of economic relations with Cuba. And in fact, the agribusiness interests in the United States are very much, very strongly in favor of relations with Cuba, because Cuba, even under current circumstances, is a big importer of agricultural goods. Practically every chicken consumed in Cuba comes from the U.S. As you know, those come out from Arkansas and places like that, which are hardly liberal progressive places, to put it mildly. So in some of the most conservative states of the Union, there are business lobbies that are very much in favor of trade with Cuba, especially agribusiness.
What do you see happening in the near future? Do you think that Cuba will get closer to the Russians?
Well, to the extent that Russia delivers in some of its grandiose promises, which I'm very skeptical about, in that sense, they may be able to achieve, get some kind of clout there. But I suspect, I have no way of proving this, of course, but I suspect that the Russian promises to Cuba are very much tied to the situation in Ukraine. And the moment that the war comes to an end, whether through a Korea-type armistice, where, as you know, to this day, peace has not been signed between North Korea and the U.S. I mean, that was, 60 years ago or more. But there is an armistice. So that's one of the possible conclusions of this process. At that point, I think Russia possibly may lose interest in Cuba. But what I forgot to say earlier, I'm sorry if I bring this up now, is that the biggest obstacle to a resumption of U.S.-Cuba relations is the political situation in Florida, where what had been previously in the, this interesting change in the 2012 and 2016 presidential elections, the Cuban American vote for Obama and then for Hillary had gone up considerably, and to was close to 50-50. I think it was like 55-45 in favor of the Republicans at the presidential level. Under Trump, that changed completely. For a combination of reasons, the Democrats are in a very bad situation in the state of Florida, and that was reflected in their inability or unwillingness or apathy, whatever it might be, to organize in, among Cubans. And Trump came into South Florida with a very considerable effort to recruit not only Cubans, but people from Venezuela, people who came from quote-unquote communist countries, and he succeeded in doing that with the help of influencers, like an infamous guy, his last name is Otaola, and they turned around the situation back to the way it had been 15 years ago.
Because there was a split, right? There were more and more Cubans that wanted an opening to Cuba.
Right. So the situation now is much less favorable in Florida. So I think that what happens in Florida, which is still, well, it's now, it's no longer an even divided state. The Republicans swept. I mean, even in Dade County, which is the county in which Miami is situated, that had been a Democratic stronghold for decades. And DeSantis obtained a huge majority in Dade County in the last time he ran for governor. So I'm sorry if I went back to that, but
That's okay. Speaking of jumping around, I was going to ask you about Cuba using tourism to boost its economy, and it seems like it had had some success with that, but you would say it's just not enough?
Yes, I think that if you look back to 2018, that was a very high point in tourism. I think it was well over 4 million a year. It didn't reach 5 million, but it was like 4.4 or 4.5, something like that. Very, very large tourist trade. Then in 2019, it began to go down because Trump made it more difficult for Cubans in the United States to travel to Cuba. And certainly for people, to make it more difficult for Americans who were not Cubans to travel to Cuba, because a lot of Americans had gone en masse in 2017, 2018. So that diminished. So that was diminished. But what really tourism very badly in Cuba was the COVID pandemic, because tourism just practically collapsed as it did in many other places throughout the world. However, if you look, for example, the Dominican Republic, that is a much larger tourist power, if you want to use that term, than Cuba ever was, the Dominican Republic was able to recuperate better than Cuba from that fall. So Cuba, I think that we are now in September, I think they have up to now 1.5 million tourists, which is better than last year, but not keeping up with the high points they reached before the pandemic. And that became a very important source for Cuba. The export of services abroad, like for example, doctors that are exported, like merchandise, to other parts of the world. And by the way, they only get about 25% of what the Cuban government charges countries like Mexico and other countries around the world for the export of doctors. That was, still is, but not at the same level as it was before. So tourism services, and particular tourism, has declined tremendously. And that's certainly part of the background to the economic crisis in Cuba.
That was Samuel Farber, a retired professor at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York. He spoke with KBOO's David Rosenberg about the closer ties that are developing between Russia and Cuba. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Michelle Coppola, and thanks for being with us. Remember, you can support content like this by donating to KBOO's fall membership drive at kboo.fm/give. Thanks so much.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Haynes. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am here with Rachel Haynes, a fifth grade teacher and member of the Portland Association of Teachers, and we're going to be tackling all things Portland teacher strike. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time on this eve of a strike to talk to us. So to start out, what is your teaching history, your background on that?
I have been a teacher for Portland Public Schools for 15 years. I started my career as a special education teacher, and I did that for 3 years. And then I moved into the elementary classroom, and I taught second grade for about 10 years. And now I am a fifth grade teacher.
Very cool. Well, the Portland Association of Teachers is planning to go on strike tomorrow, November 1st. And this is obviously huge, but there's been a lot of lead up to this moment. Can you take us through some of that timeline?
Yeah, so we've been in bargaining with the district for almost a year. And in that time, we have really tried to involve members and the community to help drive our bargain process. So there were a series of listening sessions last year with families and caregivers and surveys of members, and that really helped shape the platform for our bargain. And we've also done a lot of organizing both internally and externally, and developed really great partnerships with our partner unions in PPS and community groups and families and parents and PTAs, and really built our organizing structure internally, and did a series of actions that kind of built to this place that we're at now.
Right. And if I am recalling correctly, the teacher's contract has been expired since June. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Wow. Long time with no contract. What are some of the issues that bargaining has been hung up on, right? There's a strike because we can't come to agreement on that. What are some of the things that are still an issue?
Some of the agreements that are really at the forefront are more supports for kids. So we have seen a great increase in trauma, especially since the pandemic, and in housing insecurity, food insecurity, and so many issues that, you know, if a child comes to school and they're not sure where they're going to sleep, or if they're hungry or sleep deprived, that's going to have a huge impact on their day. So we're seeing kids really with high needs. And we also, you know, a recent report came out about sort of the dire state of mental health in Oregon in particular, that we have abysmal kind of ratios of access to mental health care, and especially for kids, one of the worst in the country, and really high need. So we're having like this convergence of all these problems. And so we really need more support. I mean, we have students who are in such heightened states of dysregulation and trauma that they're running, they're, you know, causing room clears, they're hitting adults and other students, and just in crisis. And like, we need help. We need help to support them. They need help. And one person, especially if you have a large class size, can't meet all the needs. So that's sort of how that's intertwined with class size. And I know the district has said, oh, we have really great small class sizes in one breath, and then in another breath says, in order to meet these caps, it would cost us, you know, millions and millions of dollars.
What are we talking about in terms of class size? Like, what is it now? What would it ideally be?
So we do have a threshold that that is agreed upon, that if there's more than that in a classroom, a teacher gets some compensation for that. But we actually just want smaller class sizes. The compensation really doesn't help. So we have, you know, I don't know the specific numbers off my top of my head, but it's around 24, 25 for lower elementary, 26 to 28 for upper elementary, and then I think 150 for high school. Maybe that's not correct. But in any case, we have, like, I have a fifth grade class of 30 students. My teaching partner has 31. And that's just too many students in an elementary school classroom. So that is a huge area that we're also, there it hasn't been a lot of negotiation or movement on. Basically, we've brought certain proposals that the district has chosen not to engage with at all. And so that's kind of where we've hit our standstill.
Yeah. Well, I understand teacher planning time is another one of these issues. What kind of impact does that have on your work day to day?
So having enough time to be able to plan lessons, email or call parents, have meetings after school, required meetings and meetings with special education teachers to go over somebody's individual education plan if they're in special ed. Correcting papers, all of this requires time. You know, if you think about an elementary school teacher who's teaching every subject and has to prep and plan for every subject every day, that's a lot of work. And so it feels like we have gotten more and more sort of placed on our shoulders, and the time is still the same. And so where does that come from? And you can ask any teacher if they work at home at night and on the weekends, and I'm sure the answer will be yes. So I think we're just at this point where we want to be able to do our job in our contract day and not have to try to fit things in and sort of interfere with us having a life outside of our job.
Yeah. I know anecdotally from some of the teachers in my life, or now former teachers, who were overwhelmed and kind of burnt out by that system, that that's definitely something that's been a longstanding issue. But to that idea of, you addressed the pandemic a little bit, but were these the same issues that were at play before the pandemic? How has the pandemic played into this negotiation?
I mean, these issues did exist before. I mean, if we just look at the state of education funding in Oregon, we've been underfunded for over 30 years. So this, none of this is new. You know, we've always been working at a kind of a deficit. But I think that, you know, before the pandemic, there was OEA did a whole research and put out a report about interrupted learning because of mental health crises with students. And we've seen, you know, that there is an increase in that since the pandemic. So I think, you know, we have younger kids who have not had as much experience and time in the classroom, and just having those classroom skills and being able to navigate a space with 25 to 30 other people every day, and just certain sort of, I'd say, soft skills that haven't been as developed as you might see in pre-pandemic years.
Right. Well, I'm going to hit you with something a little switching tone, because it's all about this. It's all about Strike Eve. But earlier today, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said at a press conference, and I'll quote here, "My message right now to Portland Public Schools and the Portland Association of Teachers, you need to stay at the table and you need to figure this out. Going out on strike is not in the best interest of students or families. I hope you're spending every moment between now and your self-imposed deadline to figure it out," end quote. How would you respond to her?
You know, I would hope she would realize and understand that we have hit a point where this is so unsustainable, that teachers, educators feel so demoralized and disheartened by their lack of support and lack of resources, that we need to do our job to serve our students. the fact that 99% of our membership voted, or it's a 99% strike vote, should say something about the level of, I guess, we feel like we can't wait any longer. The need is so dire that we feel like if the district cannot meet us to talk about these real issues and really negotiate on some of these key issues, then we have to show how much we need this for our students, how much we need things to change. They cannot stay the same because this is not working. You know, I've heard people say, like, this is going to disrupt learning and disrupt, make a disruption for families and students, which I totally agree it is. But I think that people don't realize how disrupted learning is every day when the people in the building are trying so desperately to meet needs that they can't because they are under-resourced. You know, this is not something that we take lightly. And our bargaining team has been, they're teachers, they're educators. So they're taking time, they're still teaching, you know, and they're taking time out to do this important work. And they have been dedicated to this process and given countless hours and so much time and effort towards this. And when proposals are met with nothing, no response, where do we go? Where right. do we go from there to show how important this really is, that we get this help that we need?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that COTEC, I guess, was touching on earlier today is parents, students, and families. What has been the response from parents so far?
I mean, we have had overwhelming support. So much just at the building sites, like families that are, you know, wanting to help with the pickets, if it comes to that, writing school board members, and just in the day-to-day, like voicing their support, wearing blue on Tuesdays, which educators do every Tuesday, to kind of show our solidarity, talking to the press, you know, just doing as much as they can to support what we are fighting for, because we know that it's important to them as well. I mean, like I said earlier, we had listening sessions and heard about what was important to families. And so, you know, our families, they know us. We have relationships with them, and they know, you know, the kind of struggles that are happening in their child's school. So it's been very supportive. We have parents that are flyering at schools, and just a really great network of support from members of the public and parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I can pivot back to the negotiations themselves, one aspect of this that I've seen kind of floating around is that Portland Public Schools is spending an inordinate amount of money or spending extra money on administration compared to teachers, compared to all these other things that your negotiation is about. How important is that piece of this?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the conversation is about whether or not there's money. And I personally am not in charge of the PPS budget.
You're not?
I'm not.
Oh, shoot. I asked the wrong person to come for this interview.
But I do think that, you know, this is their job, is to make sure that the resources that are on the ground in the classroom, that is met first. And so middle level, you know, mid management, I mean, there's been increases in middle management in PPS, and Guadalupe makes a pretty, Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero makes a pretty hefty $330,000 a year. And, you know, I think we just have to make choices about how we're spending our money. And I know that there are choices to be made about, where money is spent. Mm-hmm. And we're just arguing or fighting for money to be spent in direct student services. And, you know, that's really their job, is to figure out how to do that. We believe the money is there. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're expecting them to do.
Yeah. What has the response from PPS been like at the bargaining table? I mean, you mentioned some of that they aren't engaging with certain proposals at all.
You know, for a while, bargaining was on recorded and open, and we were able to see. At this point, it's not. So we only get what we get from, you know, press conferences and news reports. And I know from our end, our bargaining team is reporting that there has been no significant movement on some of the most important issues. And that's why the strike is happening. Mm-hmm. We feel like this has come to a head because of all the months of trying and trying and trying to negotiate around certain issues and being stonewalled.
Right. Well, again, strike eve. I just like that phrase. I've been saying it too much. But what's the response been from students? Have you talked to them about the strike, your students specifically, or how have students been involved?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard from different members about seeing like posters and support that their students have made and placed around schools. Just students saying that they support their teacher, they love their teacher. Students coming out to the rally in March on Saturday. There were a lot of students there. And I've talked to my own students about it and really just let them share their thoughts and feelings about it. And, you know, I've had nothing but support from families, and students have obviously been talking with their parents about why this is happening. And so, you know, I think they understand that we're fighting for them.
Right. Yeah. If our listeners are interested in supporting the strike or learning more about the Portland Association of Teachers' demands, what is the best way for them to do that?
They can go to PDX Teachers, that's our website, and also text support to 48744, and all our social media is PDX Teachers. So we have Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we do a lot of information there.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very nice. Well, I think I have time for another question, so I'm going to do it. There was this recent survey from GBAO that found a really significant margin of support for a teacher strike, both in Portland and across the state more broadly. Is that something that you had a sense of before those results came out?
Maybe not to the degree, but yeah, I think, you know, it's no secret that we've underfunded education, like I said, for over 30 years. And this is a huge, huge problem. And now we also have schools sort of competing for the same pot of money as other social services. So this, we have a broken tax system with the kicker, with like low corporate taxes. You know, this is a much broader problem, and it affects schools, but it affects all of our social services in the state. And so, you know, I think we've talked a lot about how even this fight for this contract is not the end. Like, yeah, we have a lot of work to do to try to make things more equitable in Oregon.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak to us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
You have been listening to myself, Althea, and I've been here with Rachel Haynes, a fifth grade teacher and member of the Portland Association of Teachers. And we've been talking about the Portland Teachers Strike, which is scheduled to begin early tomorrow, November 1st. This has been KBOO News In Depth. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Althea Billings. Till next time.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
What's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street in Portland. Dia de los Muertos is an ancient celebration originating from the indigenous people of Mexico. Festivities will include altar creation, muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, and live musical performances. Again, that's the Dia de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m.